pick up any of Ann Kimmel's books and you step into a different world. The world that Ann has changed simply by her presence and communication of her love for Jesus Christ. Ann shares this love with childlike simplicity and sincerity, building bridges between her and the people she meets as she goes through her life, sharing and loving and ministering to people. Ann is convinced that the world can be changed by ordinary people, communicating on a one-to-one basis their faith in God and love of each other through Him. Love is the motif of her life and her books, love freely offered despite rejection and struggle. Ann has authored 7 books now. She's a graduate of Northwest Nazarene College. She's been the Dean of Women at Eastern Nazarene. She knows the college scene. And of course, she's out to change her world, and she's made a tremendous impact. There's one gentleman she's made an impact on just recently, because Ann is married now, as of what, 10 months? 10 months, she's a newlywed. But as one of the most sought-after speakers, inspirational speakers in our country, it's a real special treat to welcome her this morning to Taylor University. She's going to be speaking on the subject, I Gave God Time. Let's give Ann Kimmel a warm welcome.
Hi. I'm Ann. I am human. I am imperfect. I am one simple woman in the world. I have never shaken hands with the President of the United States. I have never addressed the Senate. I live in a world of fear and hurt and pain and indifference. But I live with my back straight and my head high and a giant of a God in me. And Jesus and I and love are out to move the world. You watch. You wait. You'll see. If Jesus Christ can move the world through everyday fishermen with dirt under their fingernails, He can move the world through me. My father is a preacher. When I was a little girl, my father would pray these very long prayers before we went to school. So if we didn't get up real early and eat breakfast, we skipped breakfast because my father's prayers were so long. We had this old car. It was so ugly. It was worse than a pickup, and we called it the carryall. My sister and I would crawl down under the dash every morning. My father would drive us 2 blocks from school. He would pull over to the curb. We would open the door a crack and look out to make sure there was nobody in sight. Then we would hop out real fast, and we would walk the rest of the way to school. We didn't want anyone to know that was our car. I grew up in Hawaii. I was tall and everyone else was petite. I was white and everyone else was dark. I was Christian and all the others were Buddhist. I was a minority. I experienced a lot of prejudice. I was small and scared and overwhelmed by life. My father would take me every afternoon on walks as a little girl, and he would say, Ann, Jesus pays. And I would say, why, Daddy? I'm 8 years old, and I'm ugly, and hardly anybody likes me. Why does Jesus pay? Give God time. My mother would pull my pigtails and say, Ann, you're just a little simple girl, but someday one simple child and a great God and courage will move the world. Today, I am a 36-year-old woman. Can you believe that? I didn't even know people lived to be this old. Today, I am a 36-year-old woman, but I have come to tell you my mother was right. One ordinary human being plus God and love can do anything. In the heart of Boston, where I live, there is a ghetto neighborhood in the north end of town. I love the children there. I buy them ice cream. I hold them on my lap. I kiss their faces. Well, one day, the children in this one big old ghetto building told me that there was only one bathroom in the whole building for everybody. I couldn't believe it. So I saved all my money. I called a plumber. I took him over. We found this little storage closet, and he built another bathroom. I went to the fanciest store in Boston. I got a chintz shower curtain, four sets of color towels, a big rug, a big potted plant. I wanted everybody in that old building to know Jesus cared. And I wanted them to know in a way they could understand. Well, a few months later, I was visiting the kids, and they pulled me by my arms and my skirt down these steps into the basement of this old building. I was standing down on the steps, just overwhelmed. It had this very high ceiling. It was like a cavern down in the bottom of this old building. It was very dark. It was filthy. I could hear rats running around the corners. And I was just standing down on the steps with all these kids wanting me to go down in there with them. And suddenly I had an idea. Jesus, I know, maybe someday I could build a little gymnasium down here. Then all the kids in this deprived neighborhood would have a place to play, and maybe they could find you here. I didn't know anything about gymnasiums, but I called an architect. I marched him over with his flashlight. He looked around. I asked him how much a gymnasium would cost, and it was a lot more than a bathroom. And I had just spent all my money on this bathroom, and I didn't know how I could do this. So I called a few Christian businessmen in Boston who do a lot of things for children. And I shared with them my dream, and they said, Anne, that's extravagant. That's impossible. I mean, we could never find that kind of money. Maybe we could come up with 10% of it. But, all right, you come up with 10%, and I'll find the 90%. I didn't know how I would. I had never asked anyone for a dime in my entire life. I had always used my own money for God's and my dreams. But I wasn't really thinking about it. It was a very cold day the next day. I had bought a big bag of candy. I had passed candy out to all the kids in the neighborhood. And I had a little bit left, so I decided I would hop a cab to the other side of town, to another sort of deprived area, and hand out my last little bit of candy to one more child. It was so cold, so that I crawled into the back of this old beat-up Boston cab, and when I did, the cabbie turned around and said, Anne, hello! And I looked up and said, Bob, how are you? I know a lot of the cabbies in Boston. I ride in their cabs every week. I sing them little songs. I tell them about Jesus. This was one of my friends, and we were just visiting as we were driving across town, and he casually said, Anne, you have any new dreams for Boston? I'm always sharing with the cab drivers dreams I have for our city. I said, I do. You know that old building in the north end? I have this idea of building a little gymnasium in the basement so that all the kids around there would have a place to play. I don't know, maybe they could find Jesus there. Wow. How do you expect to pay for a thing like that? I don't know. It's just an idea. If it's God's dream, he'll make it live. And I don't believe in Jesus, remember? I know. That's okay. But Anne, I got a couple kids. I wish they had a place to play. I'd like to help. He pulled over to the curb to let me out. This cabbie in his old, battered, bashed cab pulled out this old, wadded-up checkbook out of his hip pocket. He wrote me a check for $10. It may not seem like a lot to you, but to me, it was like $10,000. I crawled out of the back seat. I paid him. I reached my hand through the front window. I grabbed his hand. I sang him a little song. I saw tears on his face, and I stood at that busy corner and wouldn't move until I could no longer see his cab in the traffic. And then before I delivered the candy, I ran a few blocks to my bank. I opened a little account. I titled it Gymnasium. I opened it with the cabbie's $10 check. And somehow that day, I really knew this was God's dream. and he would make it live. I called the architect again and told him to bring a builder, and a good one. He walked in with this man with wild, woolly hair. I didn't know what to think. I took them over to this ghetto building. The builder sort of looked around and said, Ann, I don't work in old buildings like this. I build skyscrapers in this city. I know. But, sir, this isn't just a special, an ordinary project. It's very special, and not just anybody could do it. And, sir, if you do this, you'll be a part of a dream, and everybody should have a dream. So I talked him into it. Then I said, sir, do you ever build anything 1 week at a time? And he said, well, what do you mean? Well, you see, I just put a little bathroom in this old building, and I spent all my money, so I was wondering if you could just call me every week to see how much money I've saved, and you could build a little in the gymnasium according to however much money I gave you. And I wouldn't consider it. It's not even a negotiable. I mean, I don't ever do business like that. That's out of the question. Please. Remember, it's a dream, and a dream takes faith and courage. Well, he looked very hesitant, but he agreed. And every week I began to save every dime I had. And every week the architect and builder would come to my office. Every week I would sing them a new little song. I wanted them to know Jesus too. And then old grandfathers in the ghetto neighborhood began to hear the talk of a little gymnasium for children. And they began to slip me dollar bills. And young mothers in the ghetto began to save 50-cent pieces from their grocery money and hand it to me. And the kids started putting pennies in their piggy banks. And every week we would gather everything we had, and we would hand it to the architect and the builder. And some weeks I thought the dream would never live. And after a year and a half, down a dark, foreboding street in the basement of an old, ugly, washed-out ghetto building, we dedicated a little gymnasium to the honor and glory of Jesus Christ. Today, lots of kids play there. Basketball teams, hockey leagues, exercise classes for young mothers, Bible studies. A year ago, I hired a young couple with their little son who had grown up in that neighborhood. I moved them into the old ghetto building. They don't even have windows in their apartment. Sometimes there are rats bigger than cats in their apartment. But now I save all my speaking money for them. And every week they help me in this ghetto neighborhood. I would take all the little girls for ice cream every week. One little girl, Anna, she's always looked so fragile and frail, and she would come to see me in the afternoons before ice cream, and I would say, Anna, did you have lunch today? Anna, did you have dinner last night at your house? Anna, do you have any food at your house? And week after week, I would take Anna by the hand, 10 years old. I would take her to my apartment. I would pull out frozen meat out of my freezer. I would fill her arms with fresh vegetables. I would send her home with dinner for her family. Her father had deserted them a long time ago. I always noticed that Anna's clothes were oversized, ripped, torn, hems hanging out. So one day after ice cream, I pulled Anna aside. Anna, this is a secret. No one can know but us. Promise? Anna, I'm going to give you some money, and I want you to go to the store, and you can buy anything you like to wear. I was on my way on a speaking tour, so I gave Anna $100 and sent her with Debbie, the gym director's wife. I was gone for 2 weeks. I didn't know how much it would cost to buy her clothes. I hadn't shopped for a little girl like Anna. I came home 2 weeks later and decided to take all the little girls for pizza and ice cream because I had been gone so long. We were in this little pizza parlor in their neighborhood around this long table. I let the little girls order anything they liked. I took turns holding them on my lap. They were all animated, trying to tell me all that had happened in 2 weeks. But I noticed Anna never said anything. She just sat across the table. Her face was radiant. She would take a couple bites of pizza, jump up, run around the table, throw her arms around my neck and kiss me, and then go back, sit down, eat a few more bites of pizza, hop up. We all thought it was a little strange that she kept hugging me and kissing me, but no one said anything. I was telling all the little girls goodnight at the end on this old, dark, rough neighborhood corner, and Anna waited to be last. She threw her arms around my neck and whispered in my ear, "Ann, I believe in miracles. You like my jacket? You like my jeans? I bought them with the money you gave me. And I went to this store and I bought everything I've ever wanted to wear. All my life, Ann, the kids have teased me till now. Oh, Ann Kimmel, I love you." And I wrapped my arms around this fragile small girl, Anna, 10 years old, freely, freely, you have received, Anna. Freely, freely give. Go in my name, and because you believe, others will know that I live. People say, Anna can't move the world. She's only 10. Yes, she can. Jesus can move the world through anyone who loves him. And Jesus says, "By this shall all men know that you are mine." Not that you are Protestant or Catholic. Not if you are white or black or smart or rich. Jesus says, "By this shall all men know that you are mine. That you love one another. And you just can't stop love." Every morning, I wake up with one simple prayer. Jesus, I'm just Ann. I am one simple woman. God, make me creative in the world today. Well, one morning in the heart of Boston, I awakened and thought, I know, I could become a runner. Then I could run with all the runners in Boston because so many people run. And maybe I could sing little songs to them while we run. And I could pray little prayers with them. And maybe someday I could run the Boston Marathon. I didn't know anything about running. I had been a motor moron all my life. I had never been in the junior high swim team, cross country track, but I had seen people run. It looked simple. I thought, I can do this. I got up the next morning and ran 8 miles. I got up the morning after that and ran 9 miles. And then I began to develop these terrible pains in my legs. And my toenails started falling off, and I got these horrible blisters, and I hated it. It was the hardest thing I'd ever done. It was much harder than it looked. And I was miserable, and I realized this was going to be the hardest dream of all. But how could I give up? This was God's dream. I felt it, and I could touch runners, and maybe if I didn't become a runner, I wouldn't be able to reach them. I wasn't going to be deterred. I ran every day. I ran with my socks soaked with blood. Sometimes I cried through every mile. I would get up at 5 and run in the dark if I had to fly somewhere at 7. I ran in any city or country in the world where I was. I would sometimes come in from a run and my toes were so blistered and swollen, I could barely pull my running shoes off. And that afternoon, if I had to fly somewhere to speak, I had to go to the airport in stocking feet carrying my shoes. I didn't care who stared at me. I was a woman with a mission and I was going on. Well, one day in all this process, I received an invitation from the government of Israel. Would I come to Israel to run a marathon around the Sea of Galilee December 20? December 20? I would only have been running 6.5 months in my whole life. I didn't know if I could do this. You do know, don't you, ladies and gentlemen, that a marathon is 26.2 miles and anything less than that is just a race? I just wanted to make sure you knew. Well, I decided, I didn't know if I could, but I was going to go for it. And I began to really train and try to get ready for this marathon. And one evening I was training and Jesus seemed to say, "Ann, if you're going to Israel at Christmas, take children with you from Boston." Let them see where I lived. Let them walk where I walked. Let me touch them. And then they will come home with you from Boston, and they will help you change that city. I called my accountant. He thought it was crazy. But I told him, I saved all my money. I lived in a studio apartment. I didn't own a car. Please? So he said, all right. And I began to choose children from across the city of Boston, basically from the ghettos. Black, Puerto Rican, Spanish, Jewish, Caucasian. I chose 12 children. Pablo, his parents don't even speak English. They live in a big ghetto neighborhood in the south end of Boston. I took an interpreter. The father got this incredulous look on his face. He said to the interpreter, you mean I've saved money all my life to bring my family to America, and this lady wants to take my little Pablo to Israel? He just couldn't believe it. I bought all the kids red t-shirts with big white letters on the front that said, We're Ann's Kids. I decided they would be my cheering squad. I would drop them for 26 miles along the course so that as I stumbled by, they could scream and cheer and get me through the marathon. And then after the marathon, I would take them to Jerusalem and Jericho and Bethlehem for Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. I had little presents wrapped in all their suitcases. Most of them had never had a real Christmas. We got to Israel the day before the marathon. I hadn't even recovered from 17 and a half hours of flying. I have never been so scared in my life. Everybody had talked about how much it hurts to run a marathon, that you hit the wall at mile 20, that the last 6 miles hurt more than the first 20. I hate pain. I don't know if I could do this. When we got to the start of the marathon, the kids, all in their t-shirts, jumping up and down excited, a bus was going to drop them along the course. A German had flown in from Germany, hopefully to break a world record, and all of Israeli television had come to film the German. But they suddenly noticed this American woman with her 12 children. They never even asked if they were mine. They just assumed they were mine. They were so impressed that an American lady would bring all her children, that they decided rather than feature the German, they would feature me. I was even more paralyzed. The gun went off. I had tears in my eyes. I waved to the children, and I just started running with this big van full of all of Israeli television right in front of me. At the 20th mile, when I was beginning to really wheeze and get scared, the wall, they stuck a long microphone out of one of the windows of the van. They said, Ann, we understand you like singing little songs. Could you sing us one now? I could hardly breathe. I was just overwhelmed. And I kept running and wheezing. And the only thing I could think of was, Jesus, I became a runner for you. And the only little song I could think of to sing was, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. I was not world class. I was not the first lady in the group. I was the funniest looking runner in the whole pack. I was in the middle of the race. I was a simple young American woman with a giant God and a dream in my heart. And suddenly, without my even expecting to, I was able to remind every Bedouin in a tent, every soldier in a barracks, every family across the entire country of Israel, that Jesus Christ is alive, and He is love, and Jesus Christ really can change everything. I'll shout it from the mountaintop, I want the world to know the Lord of love has come to me. I want to pass it on. Sir, can I take your hand? Or yours, ma'am? Little girl, can I play dolls with you? Can I? Because on the bottom line, that's all there is in life. You and Jesus and I and love. Just where we live. I finished the marathon in 3 hours, 35 minutes. It wasn't so bad considering it was my first. The night before we left Israel, Little Pablo, in broken English, grabbed my hand and said, "Ann Kimmel, I see you in private." He led me through the hotel corridor to this little corner. He threw his arms around my waist. He buried his face in my skirt. He started sobbing. "Ann Kimmel, oh, Ann Kimmel, you changed my whole life." And I squeezed his black curly head. "Pablo, someday you will be a man, and you and Jesus will change the world." I flew home from Israel with 12 children who will never be the same, with Jesus in their hearts and new dreams. Everybody said, "Ann, you'll never be able to run the Boston Marathon. It's less than 3 months away." The Boston Marathon is the elite marathon in the world. Not just anyone can run. You have to qualify. For a woman, you have to run another 26-miler under 3 hours and 20 minutes. Well, that would be 15 minutes faster than Israel. And everyone said, "Ann, you'll never be able to stick another marathon in and run 15 minutes." I knew they were probably right, but I wasn't going to give up. I was going to give it everything I had. 7 weeks from the day I returned from Israel, I flew to New Orleans to run my second marathon. I knew it was my last chance. I was even more frightened. When the gun went off, I told Jesus I would run as fast as I could, as hard as I could, and I wouldn't stop unless I dropped dead, and I meant it. And I started running faster than I had ever run. At the 20th mile, I was wheezing again. At the 22nd mile, I was in so much pain, I hardly knew my name. And I began to cry, "Jesus, give me this mountain. God, make this dream live. Get me to the finish fast enough. I wanted to run the Boston. That was my town. Those were my people. That was my turf." By the time I got to the finish of the New Orleans Marathon, I didn't know my own name. I was in so much pain, I was almost delirious. But as I came across the finish, I suddenly saw the clock out of the corner of my eyes. It said 3:18. I had qualified. I had 2 minutes to spare. Jesus, we did it. I ended up running the Boston Marathon that year. I have run 7 since. I ran the Boston Marathon last April again. For 26 miles along the course, I sang little songs to all the runners. I patted children's heads as I ran by. I grabbed their hands, for thousands of children were on the route as I ran along. I screamed out for miles, "God loves you! I'm your friend. Never give up. Jesus cares." When I came across the finish of the Boston Marathon this last year, I heard this child voice coming from nowhere, where only the runners were allowed. And I looked down, and there was little Pablo. The week before, he had written me a letter. "Dear Ann Kimmel, me without you is nothing. Me without you is lonely. On day of marathon, I wear my t-shirt. I run 3 miles with you. You and Jesus do it before. You and Jesus do it again. Love, Pablo." When I came across the finish and heard that child voice, I looked down. Pablo was standing there, tears streaming down his face. "Oh, Ann Kimmel, today is my birthday. I run all the way from my housing project. I run to see you and Jesus do it again, Ann Kimmel. You and Jesus, you can do it every time. Today, I no longer live in Boston. 10 months ago, I married an Idaho potato rancher businessman and moved from the heart of Boston to Idaho. I had a choir of ghetto children precede me down the aisle singing in my wedding. I hugged their necks. I kissed their faces. I told them goodbye. I still go back once a month to Boston to hold them on my lap, to buy them ice cream, to sing them little songs, and to give them courage to still be true. But today, Pablo, Anna, they are there taking my place, reminding that dark, hollow corner that Jesus lives. Today I have come to tell you, My father was right. Jesus pays. I have come to tell you, let Jesus plant a dream in you. A dream that is not like mine, but unique to you. A dream that is greater than you, that will make you stand on your tiptoes and reach. A dream that will take all of God and all of you to make it live. I've come today to tell you, dreams are hard. 10 months ago, when I left the heart of Boston to move to a little town in Idaho, I didn't realize how tough it would be. 5 weeks after my marriage, I was hit by a speeding car, thrown through the air, 38 stitches on my face, and barely lived. I've had 2 miscarriages in the last few months, and I think the hardest thing of all is that suddenly, for the first time in my life, I no longer have structure. I no longer am in control of my own life. I no longer live in the heart of Boston with some great dream or mission. I'm in a tiny new little community, and it's been a struggle trying to figure out who I really am and what God wants me to be and do in this new little city. I think I've experienced more personal pain than I ever have in my life. I'm crazy about my husband. I love being married, but it seems that I've had a lot of adjustment. And last week, in the midst of tremendous soul searching, Jesus seemed to say to me, Anne, remember when you were a little girl and you were so afraid and you were overwhelmed by rejection? Well, for 35 years, you've tried to be very productive, very smart, very creative, tried to love so that the world would love you. You've tried to make sure all the rest of your life that you would never be rejected again. And you started at a pure place. But in 35 years, rather than my being the idol of your life, your own self-esteem has become the idol of your life. And you needed productivity and you needed missions in order to make sure that everybody loved you and thought you were a wonderful person. And today the idol of your life is you. And 10 days ago, Jesus seemed to really reveal to me all that I had been struggling with in the last 10 months. And Jesus seemed to call me back to a new, pure place of letting Him be the focal point of my life. I confess that to you today. I confess to you that dreams are hard, that I am so human and so imperfect. But the desire of my heart today is to be one quiet, simple human voice in the world, just one, to remind you that if you run the race and keep Jesus at the center, someday you and Jesus and love will move the world if we never give up. If we are true, I have come to tell you one last thing. Give God time. I waited 35 years for this man in my life. It takes Jesus a lot of years to make dreams live. It takes Jesus a lot of years to put all the pieces together. And when the world seems big and you feel scared and overwhelmed, remember there's a lady named Anne who is running the race with you. I love you. I need you. And someday when I am old and gone, you with younger blood and fresher spirit will still be here in the world to take my place. And I hope you never get tired of calling the world to Him and reminding the world that love is vital and real and moving. God bless. I was wondering tonight if you would like to meet my husband. Would you? My husband was a 37-year-old potato farmer when he met me. Honey, share something with them.
I thought she was pretty good. When I finished up my work, in grad school where I was studying more about potatoes and went out to work with my father developing new ground, busting up sagebrush, plowing it under, drilling wells, putting up circle systems and planting potatoes. I left a lot of Christian activities, a lot of close friends at school where I was very involved. And all of a sudden, I went through a transition where there were very few Christians around me. We were in the third largest county in Idaho, and there were only 1,300 people in the whole county. It was really the backside of the desert. And we were at the end of a dirt road, and I lived in a bunkhouse. And I was lonely. And I said, God, why have you put me out here? There's hardly anybody to talk to. I don't have any friends here. I don't understand. And I had a little room, just a little bit bigger than a bed, that I stayed in every night. We worked long hours. And one night I was so lonely and so discouraged, I got down on my knees, and I don't cry very easily, but I was really choked up then because I was so discouraged. And I said, God, why am I here? And it talks in the Old Testament about a small, quiet voice that speaks to us sometimes. And it was very clear at that moment that God said, Will, I've taken you out of all the activities you've been involved in because I want to deal with you. You've been so busy that I really haven't been able to communicate with you. I want you to learn to read the Bible, and I want you to learn to pray. Well, I'd prayed before. I've been pretty consistent in it. And I said, well, God, what do you want me to pray about? And I got out a piece of paper, and I started writing down things that I could pray for. And I'd date it, and I was committed to praying for those things. Some of them were people, some of them were events. And one of the things that I put on this small list was, Father, give me a woman of God. And I started listing things that I could pray for in her life. Open up the Bible. May she be effective in other people's lives. May she have a happy spirit. Protect her, Father. And then little simple things like, give her a fun day tomorrow. If she cooks anything tomorrow, may it turn out all right. And it was just fun listing things that I could pray for. About 10 years later, my sister, one of my two sisters, I'm the oldest, heard Ann Kimmel speak. And she turned to my old roommate, who was her husband, and said, Tom, that's the girl for Will. And he looked at her and said, you really think so? And she said, absolutely. So afterwards, she fought her way through the crowds, being a persistent young lady, loving her brother an awful lot, and she walked up and shook Ann's hand and said, I'd like you to meet my brother. She'd only heard that about 100 times from mothers and sisters who had sons and brothers. Well, they went home that night and called me on the telephone and said, Will, we found the girl for you. Well, I don't know how many of you guys out there have heard that from sisters or mothers. I'd heard it many times. I don't remember if I hung up on her that time or not. But I'd never heard of Ann Kimmel. I'd been out in the desert for so long that I was kind of out in touch with a lot of things. I'd never read any of her books. Well, Julie kept bugging me. And for 4 years, every night she prayed that I'd meet Ann Kimmel. Meanwhile, I was praying every night, Father God, prepare a woman of God for me. And when you start praying for somebody, what happens is that you look at yourself and say, well, what if I do get this person? Am I the man that I need to be to meet her needs? And that was very sobering. So I started praying for myself. Lord, make me the kind of guy that she needs. Make me strong where she's weak. Build in my life those things that she needs. Well, Julie started praying for me, and then she got my sister to pray and my mother to pray, and then her Bible study to pray, and then she started calling people all over the United States that she knew to pray that her brother would meet Ann Kimmel, and I didn't know any of this was going on. So last year, I won an award. National Award on Potatoes, and they flew me to Chicago. But before I went, Julie called me up on the telephone and said, you know, God has really put this together so you can meet Ann, I know. And I said, Julie, Chicago's not even close to Boston. And she said, I know, but you're gonna work it out. Well, I checked the plane fares, and sure enough, it was almost cheaper to fly to Boston via Chicago than it was just to Chicago and home, so I put the ticket together and call up Ann's office. And I dial the number, and the secretary answered, and I said, my name's Will Anderson, may I speak with Ann Kimmel? And she said, oh, Mr. Anderson, I'm sorry, but she's in conference right now. And I said, when will she be out? Well, she's pretty busy, maybe this afternoon. So I call in the afternoon, oh, Mr. Anderson, I'm sorry, she just left. Well, 8 calls later, I got the idea that I was getting the runaround, that this secretary is very well trained to keep strange men away from her boss. My dad taught me that there was no excuse for man failure. There's no excuse for not getting the job done. That's what I was raised on. So I sent her a telegram. And the telegram read, Dear Ann, 37-year-old potato farmer, would like to take you out for a steak dinner as long as you don't order stovetop stuffing with your steak. We're brainwashed in Idaho. Well, that got response. 3 days later, I got a note in the mail, and it was from her secretary, and it said, Dear Will, Ann will be happy to meet with you between 5 o'clock and 7:30 on Tuesday, November 24th. And I looked at that, and I said, what kind of date is that? I'm going into Boston, and I'm going to have it from 5 to 7:30 in the afternoon? Well, I figured that's all right. So I flew in, and as things worked out, we got together that evening. One thing led to another. And I guess looking back, I kept throwing out so many fleeces. Because when you pray so long for something, you're scared. And when I got through throwing out fleeces, I was covered in fleeces. And the thing, I guess, looking back, and it sounds funny now, I guess, but the thing that really bothered me the most was I thought she was too skinny. And I love it now. I love it now. But we went to Israel together this last Christmas with a group of girls that she was taking. I was one of the chaperones. It was a very platonic relationship. I never held her hand. I never kissed her. And I guess it was the last day. We'd had a baptismal service there in the Sea of Galilee. And I guess it was that last day, and I was going through emotions that I'd never experienced before. I was riding a bus from the Sea of Galilee to the Mediterranean, going to a kibbutz to spend some time with some people on drip irrigation. And I was going through the little town of Nazareth with all these emotions running through my gut. And it was a physical experience that I'd never had before. It was like there was a steel ball in my gut, a steel egg that God was reaching in and breaking and peeling back. And inside was this big ball of tenderness, compassion, warmth, love that I'd never experienced before. It was a physical sensation that made me almost sick. It was so heavy. And I looked out the window as we were going through Nazareth, and I realized what the scribes and Pharisees said. Could anything good come out of the city of Nazareth? Because it was a dirty, dingy, miserable, ugly-looking town. And I realized that appearances mean nothing. But she led us back on the airplane, so to speak, as our leader of the tour. And as we were approaching Kennedy Airport, she said, Will, where do you think our relationship's going? Because she's a pretty upfront individual. And I said, Ann, I don't know. I'm nervous about the cruise syndrome. I don't want emotions in a neat setting and a neat trip to get us off on the wrong track, guide us in the wrong direction. Let's go home and sleep on it for a couple of weeks, and I'll call you up. 2 weeks later, I called her up and said, Ann, I think you should come to Idaho. She said, Well, that's interesting. You should call the day. I'm leaving tomorrow for Spokane and Portland and Seattle on a speaking tour, and I could stop by on the way back, and it wouldn't cost anybody anything. And I said, thanks, Lord. She came to Idaho for a week, and somewhere in the middle of that week, our relationship definitely changed from platonic to something much more than that. And at the end of the week, we went skiing in McCall, Idaho. My sister Julie was there. Her skis didn't touch the ground most of the time. And a couple from Germany that were doing Christian work in Germany, they came over. And for 3 days, we skied and had a great time. It was the most romantic setting I've ever seen. The skies were blue, the snow was crisp, and this marathon runner just loves to cross-country ski. But it was very apparent at that point that this was the woman that I'd prayed for 10 years, every night, that in her life, he'd prepared the areas that I was weak in, she was strong in. And the areas that I was strong in, I could help her with. And it was exciting. But still being nervous and scared, I said, let's wait a month. Let's not tell anybody. Let's ask God for no's. He's given us all these yeses. So for 30 days, we waited for no's, and every day was a yes. And on March 1st, we stood up in a small congregation in Idaho Falls, and I introduced the future Mrs. Ann Anderson.
I guess in running the race, in nurturing this dream planted deep within you, I just want you to never forget that the most important thing of all is this. Give God time. It really does take Jesus a lot of years to put all the pieces together in our lives. Give him long enough to do that. Before I married Will, he would call me and say, Ann, if you are burned all over your body before June 7th, on June 7th, I'm going to marry you. You are God's woman for me. Ann, if you get multiple sclerosis before June 7th, I am marrying you and committing my life to you because you are right for me. And I would say, Will, if you lose both your legs before June 7th, or tell me you're going to grow potatoes in Cuba and China for the rest of our lives, on June 7th, I'm going to walk down an aisle and commit my life to you because I know you are God's man for me. Something powerful happens between the Savior and a human being, or between a woman and a man, or a person and a person, when you make that kind of commitment. Jesus, I will follow you to the end. Not if you heal my brother or give me a husband or wife or make me financially secure, but Jesus, I will follow you to the end because you are truth and I am committed to you. Something powerful happens in life on that level. I have come to say, Jesus answers prayer. Jesus changes everything. Carry a dream. I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, not Anne. I'm a sinner saved by grace. It is not my story. It is not my song. It is his. He is the hope and the promise on every early morning sky for me. We will run together, and when the world seems too big and you feel afraid and small and overwhelmed, there's a lady named Anne out there running somewhere with you and a giant God leading the way. I love you. I care. I know what it's like to be alone. I'm glad you were here tonight. I'm glad we're friends. God bless.
This is just a question and answer period. You can ask me anything you like. You can disagree with me. If you would just call out a question, I think even where you're seated, I will repeat it so everybody can be sure and hear it, and then I will try to answer it. Does anyone have anything you'd like to ask? How long have I been a Christian? I invited Jesus Christ into my life when I was 8 years of age at a Billy Graham movie. It was not until I was a junior in college that I really had to choose whether or not I was going to give Jesus all my life. I think there is such a great difference between asking Jesus to forgive me, that's something he does for me, and then the real difference comes when I choose to lay down my life for the rest of time for him. And as a junior in college, it was a very great struggle and a big decision. Would I do what my father said, follow Jesus? What if he never gave me my dreams? What if he never brought into my life all the things I had really hoped for? And to surrender the future of my life, whatever that meant, I did that as a junior in college, and again today, as I said last night, at 36 years of age, I can say my father was right, following Jesus pays. Someone else? My twin sister. I have an identical twin sister. If she were here, you would probably struggle trying to figure which one was Anne. She is, well, before my husband, you know, but my best friend in the whole world. I said, you know, she was with me before life was with me. And if I wrote 100 books in my heart, deep down inside, I guess in a certain way they all go to Jan. She is married to a businessman. She has two little sons, one who will be 5 this week, and the little other little boy who was 2 in December. And since from the time they were newborns, I have stopped in Cleveland, scooped these little babies up with bottles and diapers and flown them with me all over the country. Once I took them when Trey was 3 and Nash was 1.5 years, I took these two babies for 10 days on the road with me, with speaking at conventions with these two little babies. For 10 days, I never shared Jesus with anybody. For 10 days, I never opened the Bible. I didn't even say good night to the Lord. I just collapsed in bed every night, hoping I'd get to sleep before they woke up. My sister is a full-time, has a private practice, is a psychologist, and has 2 men who work under her so that she only works 2 full days a week, maybe 21 clients, and she refers all the others to the 2 men who work with her so that she has time for her children and her husband. And probably more than anyone, she has taught me to be authentic. Everybody has struggles. I think Jan's greatest struggle is trying to feel valuable when so much of the world puts so much emphasis on me. People will come running up to her in a shopping center and say, "Are you Ann Kimmel?" And sometimes she says, "I get so tired of people asking me, I just smile and say yes and go on." But you know, recently we spoke at a convention together. She spoke first and then I spoke. And I knew I had to autograph for a long while after. And she had one of her babies with her. And she said, "I'm going to take him up to the room." We were in a hotel while you autograph. It was late at night. And the whole time I autographed, I could hardly choke back the tears because I knew Jan was up in the room crying. Feeling like, you know, God loved me more because it seemed like the whole world loved me more than they loved her. And when I got up to the room, I went in and she crawled out of bed where she'd put the baby down. And we threw our arms around each other in the bathroom and we cried and cried and cried. "Oh, Jan, I wish the world wouldn't put value on people who write books and speak. I wish the world would put value on the hearts and the souls and the authenticity of people." And my sister cried and cried, and all she could say was, "Oh, Anne, I just wish I could learn to just accept God's place for me and be contented with that, knowing that he loves me as much as he loves you." Sometimes it's hard, but she's very, very significant. I hope someday you can meet her. That's wonderful. I have a private therapist in my family. All I have to do is call her and I get free therapy anytime. Someone else? Have I always been bold? When I was a child, I was very shy and inhibited. I felt like the ugliest child in the world. I felt like I was definitely in the minority. I was very afraid. But you know, as a child, even when it came time to going to school, we grew up in Hawaii, and several times at different schools, the principal would call my parents and say, I think you ought to send the twins somewhere else. I have an older brother too, but you know, he was maybe more resilient. But the principal would say, that school they're going to, that junior high, is very rough, and it's got a lot of rough influence, and I don't think the twins would fit in well. And my father and mother would sit us down and say, we don't really have money to send you to a private school, and we've told you all your lives that God is bigger than the world and greater than all the struggles and impossibilities in the world. And we want you to go to this school, and we want you to prove and test the greatness of God. And as children, my parents sort of forced us out to stand on our own and be strong. And I really believe process leads you to wider places of confidence and courage. It's process. And at first, I was so shy to share Jesus. And really, I started sharing Jesus boldly when I was a teacher. And I had accelerated students, and I felt I was a good teacher, but it came to me over and over again that if I didn't share Jesus, my life was meaningless. And I would come in from school and I would fall on my knees in the door with my coat still on, and I would cry and cry, Jesus, I hear preachers talk about changing the world, but they don't tell me how to do it. I don't see people falling in line after them coming to church from their neighborhoods. I don't know how to do this. And so one day, as a junior high teacher, between classes, I just scooted my chair back and just walked out into the hall and started grabbing kids. I was mortified, but it was a sheer act of my will, a decision that I was going to share Christ. And I knew between classes I would have more freedom to do that. I was in a very secular school. And I would grab kids and say, do you go to church anywhere? I didn't know how to say, do you know Jesus? Just, do you go to church? You don't. Would you go to church with me? Because if you will, I will buy you a hamburger and a Coke afterwards. That was when McDonald's were like 15, 17 cents a hamburger. Well, the first Sunday, I had 5 junior high kids. You know, well, guy, Miss Kimmel, well, I guess I could. The first Sunday, I had 5 kids in my little Carmen Ghia. The next Sunday, I squeezed in 7. And I went to the senior minister at this large church and said, could you give me a bus? I think I could fill it. And, well, he thought that was a little extreme. I mean, after all, sending a bus clear across town and... Well, I said, you talk about trying to win the world. If you don't give me a bus, I don't know how I can get these kids over here. So he said, well, we'll try it one Sunday. And he sent a bus and a driver, and I began filling the bus with kids. I would invite them between classes. I started off terribly afraid, and I started off only knowing how to invite them to my church. And as I was obedient in that, Jesus, through process, led me to a more secure place of more and more sharing Jesus and talking to them about my Savior. And the more I did it, the more open I realized people were, the more hungry, the more confidence I gained. And I guess today I just can't imagine being intimidated by Jesus Christ in my life. To me, I want the whole world to know. He is the sunrise in my life. I love telling people that. And I think it's very important not to coerce people, not to overpower them, not to shove them in a corner. I sat down next to a man once on an airplane who was reading a newspaper. And when I sat down, he kind of put the paper down and looked at me and said, are you going to Denver? I am. What are you going to do there? I'm going to speak. What do you talk about? Did you really want to know? Yeah. Jesus, that he laughs and cries with me, that he's my friend. And you may not believe this, sir, but Jesus and I are out to impact the world. Oh, he put his face back behind the newspaper. You say, Ian, were you depressed because he didn't feed into it, because he wasn't open? Did you keep trying to talk to him through the newspaper? No. When they brought our meal trays and he put the newspaper down, I didn't say anything more about Jesus because I knew if he wanted to know, he would ask. I talked about his home, his children, his wife, his job. I tried to build a bridge. I think you do one of two things. You build a wall or a bridge to every person you meet in life. I wanted to build a bridge so that the next time this man encountered a Christian, he would be open and receptive and understand that love was the ruling force. So in my boldness, I love you, I don't care what you do. One night I was invited to this highbrow dinner across the street from where I live. I was very afraid. I went across the street. The host said, "Ann, could you say a little prayer? I bet no one here has ever heard a prayer." And so I said, "Well, all right." I was very shy because they were all smoking marijuana. So I waited for them to put their marijuana down, and I prayed a little prayer. And about 20 minutes later, another lady came, and the host said, "Ann, pray for her. I bet she never heard a prayer either." Well, I thought it seemed extreme to pray twice at this secular, sophisticated dinner, but so I prayed again, and they began starting to ask me questions, and I started singing them all my little songs, and I noticed some of them were crying. But at 9:30, I got up, I shook all their hands, I told them goodnight, and I ran back across the street to where I live. I never made a judgment on them. I never tried to preach to them, "I'm good and you're bad." It was, "You're a person and I'm a person and I love you and I'll walk with you and I'll stick by you. Jesus is my Savior. He's my whole life. But if you're at the other end of the continuum, that's okay. You can count on me to stick by you through thick and thin." And I think it's allowing people that space and loving them in spite of who they are or their lifestyle that in time leads them to Christ. Some people come to Christ more easily than others. Some people I will probably love and pray for and reach out to till I die, and I will never see it fulfilled. But I will believe for them as long as I live. Someone else? Yes.
Of all the books I've written, which one is my favorite? Well, to tell you the truth, I never read my own books. I write them, and I write them from my heart and from my own human experience and try to be vulnerable and honest in them. But once they come out, I look at them and I think, this is embarrassing. I don't know why they ever published this. And I just can't bear to read my own books. Each book really represented a different place in my life. I think Yes was the most difficult book to write because I wrote it from my heart. Yes to singleness, yes to loneliness, yes to fear, yes to anything, Jesus, that you bring into my life, I will follow you to the end. When you make that kind of a statement to the world, it is very sobering because you don't know where it's going to lead. And today, even yet today, I don't know where that commitment is going to lead me. And I say to Will, honey, every morning, you know, I pray, Jesus, bring into our lives everything we need to keep us humble and pure and truly committed to you, centered and whole. And I say to Will over and over, sometimes in the morning when we're still in bed, honey, we don't know where that's going to take us. What it's going to take to get us to the kingdom, to help us run this race with victory and run it to win. We don't know what that's going to cost. I think Yes was the most difficult book. But then I'm Running to Win took more physical pain than I'd ever experienced. Faithfulness is so tough. I don't know. I just know that my books are very simple. There are many people, probably some of you in this audience today, who are far more skilled as writers than I will ever be. I know that Jesus has not made me an author and made my books big sellers because I'm a great writer. I think he just looked down and said, "Who can I choose in the world to share my love in a simple way? I think I'll choose that young lady named Anne." And he put his hand on my life, and he anointed it, and it's beyond anything I understand. I only know that my commitment is not to be a great writer. It's not to speak to millions. My commitment is to love Jesus with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to take his love to my little corner of the world. if I can't do that, if I'm not genuine and a real Christian in my neighborhood, my life is garbage. I do not think writing a book makes a person significant. But I thank God for the opportunity. And I thank you, those of you who have loved my books. Thank you. That is very special to me. Yes. I could tell you a lot of things. Well, there's this man in a wheelchair on his front porch, and I would always run by and see this man in the wheelchair and wonder about him. He was an older man. So one morning, I ran by up to his porch, grabbed his hand, and said, "Hello, my name is Ann. I had this idea. I could sing you a song." And he seemed very shocked, but I thought I'd better hurry. So I looked at him, and I sang, "God loves you, and I love you. And that's the way it should be. Jesus loves you, and I'm your friend, and I see you sitting in this wheelchair. Sir, what is your name?" "Jay." "Jay, why are you in a wheelchair? I want to know." "I have multiple sclerosis, and I've had it for 15, 16 years. My wife divorced me the year I came down. It was discovered. I live here alone. Every day if I run by, I sing him little songs. I bake him fresh cookies every week. Even if I'm flying out of town, I take him freshly baked cookies. I started taking Will over there. Honey, he needs a man. This man needs another man in his life. So I started dragging my husband over, and we would buy ice cream. And my husband would feed him ice cream, and I would tell him about the simple truths of Jesus. And when Johnny was showing the movie, we took him in his wheelchair and we put him on the aisle, and my husband fed him popcorn while he watched the movie. And he just wept through the movie. And before Christmas, Will and I invited 40 professional people from Idaho Falls, our attorneys, physicians, travel people, insurance. Anyway, we invited them, and I had a buffet for them. And I showed my documentary film on my life, just to make a statement, this is who I am. It was just during their lunch hour before Christmas. And then Will and I gave our testimonies, and it was so exciting. People really responded. There are two ladies in my neighborhood who run very slow, but I was running up to my porch one day after running. I saw these two ladies, middle-aged, coming very slowly around the corner, but I thought, they're in my neighborhood. I went flying out to the street and said, "My name is Ann. Do you ladies run every day?" "Well, yes. I mean, we're pretty slow. We're 10-minute milers." Oh, that was really, at first it was like walking fast for me. But then I learned to run real slow with them. And I run with them every morning, at least a few miles. They don't run as many miles as I do. So I run a few miles with them every morning, then I run my extra miles faster. I sing them little songs every day. I pray with them. One is comes from a Catholic background. The other is Mormon. And I could tell you, Jesus has opened so many doors in this neighborhood for me with people in the neighborhood, just spontaneous. You know, when you pray every morning, "Jesus, use me. Jesus, make me creative." It's amazing the opportunities he brings into our lives. I don't know. Does that give you an idea? Yes. "Since my marriage, do I still work out of my Boston office?" "No. I closed everything down in Boston except the gymnasium program. I have the full-time couple that I support myself, and they run the gym program. I go to Boston once a month. I hold the children on my lap. I buy them ice cream. I kiss their faces. I sing them little songs. The last time I was there, I took this one little brother and his sister to a special little cookie store. And I spent time with all the other children, but these two children are especially deprived. And I bought them each a great big cookie before I put them on the subway to go back to where they live. And I kissed them and I hugged them and I turned around to leave them. And I walked a few steps, and I had tears in my eyes, and I turned around, and they had stopped, and they hadn't gone out the door the other way toward the subway. This little Spanish girl and boy were just standing there looking at me, watching me leave, like, are you really going to leave us again?" It just, I could hardly stand it. And yet, they're carrying on and they're learning to follow Jesus. They're learning to put their trust in Him. And I've moved to Idaho because that's where my husband is. And that's where God's called me. Someone said to me the other day, Ann, do you feel as challenged in Idaho Falls, Idaho, as Boston? I mean, Boston is exciting. And it seems like it would be more of an opportunity. I couldn't believe it. I honestly couldn't believe that somebody would think that God's will was more significant in Boston than Idaho Falls. To me, the highest, the greatest is God's will. If He moves us to South Africa, if He moves us to Cuba, if He moves me to wherever, the will of God is the ultimate. Boston, Idaho Falls, wherever. I am so excited and challenged. And the greatest challenge of my life today is to be a wife to Will Anderson. To love the world. But if I fail to love my husband, if I fail to be a homemaker, if I fail to really lay down my life for my husband and my home, I know I have failed in totality. But I say to you today, many of you, most of you maybe who are singles, I know that happiness is not in being single or married. Happiness is not in having a lot of money or beautiful children or a striking husband or wife or a fancy house. Happiness is being centered in Jesus. I know it sounds simple, but I really believe that. I've been on both sides. There are pluses and negatives on both sides. Now I have a husband to hold me on his lap, to drink hot chocolate with me, to eat popcorn late at night, to laugh and cry with me. I'm crazy about this man. But now sometimes I fly home from trips and there are dirty clothes in the closet. And dishes in the sink. And I just can't eat cold cereal if I feel like it. I've got this big man to feed. And, you know, some days he wants to do something and I want to do something else. And when you're alone, you have a whole different creative world that is very unique and different from when you're married. I wouldn't change anything from where I am today. But I know that happiness, you know, if you will delight yourself in the Lord, He will give you the desires of your heart. As I delighted in the Lord, He became the desire of my heart. And when I wasn't even desiring a man any longer, He brought Will Anderson to me. But today, as crazy as I am about Will Anderson, Jesus is the highest desire of my life. And I know that's true of my husband. I pray for you happiness where you are. I pray for you contentment where God has put you. I know that Jesus is the fulfillment. One more question. Anyone? How did I know it was God's will for me to be married? I guess I think all of life is built around yeses or nos. I have always, with any dream, to test it, whether it was Anne's dream or God's, with marrying this man, I built around Jesus, you either give me yeses or nos, specific, loud yeses or nos, so that I know this is your plan for me. My greatest desire is not to miss your plan, your program for me. And as Will said last night, he was covered with so many fleeces he couldn't move. He kept throwing out fleeces, Lord, if I'm supposed to marry this woman, you know. And he looked at me and said, you mean, Lord, I waited 38 years for her, but she's not my idea of what I, you know, she's too skinny and I had this idea of a voluptuous woman. And anyway, he would look at me and say, I can't believe, Lord, I've waited 38 years, but if this is your program, Lord, yes to it. And I would look at him and say, Jesus, I know you're not calling me out of Boston. I mean, Boston's my home. And farming, I've never camped out in anything but a Hilton. I don't know one thing about camping out or farming. I've never grown a garden. I haven't waited 35 years to marry a potato farmer. Well, Lord, who am I to question? This your will? I'll obey. And before Will and I loved each other, we obeyed God. It was obedience. And as we obeyed, God brought this tremendous level of romance and emotion and love into our lives. Yeses. I prayed for very specific yeses. And God gave me yeses all along the way. Sometimes I said, Lord, I'm going to study it, make a decision. I'm not going to wait for a lot of you. I'm going to make a decision. And if it's wrong, slam the door in my face. If it's wrong, show me. Because otherwise, I don't know. And I know you've given me a brain and a good head. And he's always been faithful to do that. I have come today to tell you, I am only one simple woman in the world. But I am one. And one simple human being, plus a giant God and a determined spirit, can do anything. I'd rather have Jesus than silver or gold. I would. I'd rather have Jesus than riches untold. I would. I'd rather have Jesus than houses or lands or a husband or a wife or books or money or security that the world offers than to be the queen of a vast domain. I'd rather have Jesus than anything. For me, Jesus Christ is the hope and song of every day. I pray for you courage. I pray for you the decision to follow him and to give him your best. It is a decision. It's a choice of the will. When I got out of bed this morning, I was so exhausted from yesterday and so tired, and I knew it was cold, and I didn't really want to run 10 miles. I wanted to stay in bed with my husband, but he pushed me out. He stayed in bed. I pulled on my running clothes, and I went out because it was a decision. It was a choice of my will to get out. I knew that my day would be better if I did that. Following Jesus, giving your best, choosing to be happy. It's a decision of your will to be happy or unhappy and to accept God's place for you. I pray for you bright, happy tomorrows. I care for you. I know that a lot of you have a lot of lonely places. I've been there too. The sunrise will come. You watch. You'll see. Jesus, do you see us here today? Make us strong where we're weak. Make us bold where we're scared. Make us forgiving instead of critical and judgmental and harsh. God, make us authentic instead of superficial and hollow. And may the world never be the same because you live in us. Because they see your sparkle in our eyes. They feel your warmth in our voices. May we have the courage not only to say we love you to people, but may we have the courage to prove it in simple, quiet little ways. God, if you could move the world through 12, move the world through us. Amen. God bless.
If you enjoyed this presentation by Ann Kimmel Anderson, then you'll want to listen to her personal testimony recorded on another Lifelifters tape. You'll also benefit from her 8-cassette resource with study guide on being a Christian in today's world. It's titled, Love is Something You Are, 10 Sessions on Christian Discipleship. For more information about these and hundreds of other tapes, books, and films available from Word Publishing, see your local Christian bookstore or write to Word Incorporated, Educational Products Division, Waco, Texas, 76796.